So what we're going to talk about is why this is such an exciting and interesting time in South Africa's political life. And we're going to talk about some of the challenges that any new government will face when they take office at the end of April. The South Africans have called elections for April 22nd, so towards the end of this month, there'll be a new face, and I'll turn that off if I need to. It's on green?
It's on green. It's recording.
Okay, excellent. And we're going to give you discuss a set of policy changes or policy recommendations that we believe would be important for this new government to consider moving forward. I'd like to say, though, caveat at the beginning, because I am trained as a lawyer, and lawyers always need their caveats, and I always do this for CHC. The issues that we focused on in this policy series are by no means exhaustive concerns that the new government has to face. What we did instead was we focused on a pretty small set of issues that we think are actually symbiotic. It's okay. And what I may do is just turn this off and use, as I said a few minutes ago, my big voice. So we're going to talk about a set of three domestic issues that we think are interrelated and provide some policy recommendations in those areas. This is not to say that there aren't other important areas. For instance, we're not going to talk about land reform today, and that's an enormously important issue in South Africa. And then we're going to talk about a series of foreign policy issues that we think are of a special concern for a new South African government. The way we're going to divide up the talk is I'm going to talk about the domestic issues, maybe, and my co-author, Johan van der Walt, is going to talk about the foreign policy issues. And I know he looks like he's really young. He looks really young to me, but he's really smart. So you're going to hear, we're going to hear good things from him. So let me move forward, and Chris is going to stop me, though, before we move forward. It's something about me. Okay, thanks. So we're good. So we're going to continue. It's probably important for an American audience, less so for a South African audience, but important for an American audience to remember that any South African government that takes control at the end of April is facing enormous challenges. Challenges that are related to poverty, challenges that are related to a poor educational environment, challenges that are related to crime and security, and then a host of foreign policy challenges. And sometimes people think, oh, you know, it's really terrible the ANC hasn't done a better job. They haven't really solved these problems of pretty serious poverty and crime in the country. In fact, last night, Archbishop Desmond Tutu was kind of lambasting the ANC. In his case, he was saying, look, you guys are not gods. You need to be a little bit more humble, perhaps, in terms of your policies and the actions that you take. This, of course, in following up on South Africa's refusal to grant a visa to the Dalai Lama to attend a peace conference. But there's some real discord, some real dissatisfaction in the South African society that the ANC, which took power in 1994 with so much promise, has in some ways not lived up to that promise. But let's give the ANC a little bit of credit, because they took over a country that was really in quite difficult straits in 1994. So there had been, for centuries, laws, social norms in place that made it very difficult for the black population in South Africa, for the colored population in South Africa, and even for the Indian population in South Africa to thrive the way that the white population in that country had been able to. So the ANC government took control in 1994 at the end of the apartheid era through a unity government. And what did they face in 1994? Well, they faced a pervasive history of discrimination. And this discrimination had been built into the legal framework of South Africa. And so you'll see that on this particular slide, we've just picked three of the possible, out of a possible large list of legislative restrictions on the ability of black South Africans in particular to do what human beings do naturally. Things like move, things like build businesses, things like pursue educational opportunities, things like travel to visit families, things like engage in creative entrepreneurship had all been severely limited by the white governments before 1994. And so when the ANC took control in that year, it faced this problem of having a very bifurcated society, a society in which there were some people who had good educational opportunities, a society in which some people held lots of high-level jobs and had lots of job training, a society in which schools were separate and not equal, not even an attempt to create a separate but equal situation. So you had a series of schools who weren't meeting student needs, that weren't training students. And you had people living in this peculiar situation where many people had been shunted off physically, coercively, to undesirable areas of the country because white farmers had taken the more desirable bits of land. You had people who were living in townships outside of cities but having to travel long distances into city centers to find employment. So in many different ways, geographically, socially, economically, a bifurcated country. And we should remember that the ANC has been in control of the country for 15 years, and 15 years is actually a pretty short time. And so while undoubtedly the government has made mistakes, because governments are just people and people make mistakes, and while there's undoubtedly a lot of good that can come from a new government, a lot of policy changes that might improve the landscape for the poor, we shouldn't be surprised that 15 years later, all the problems aren't solved. It might have been unrealistic to expect more. So I want to talk for a minute about what's happened since 1994 in that transition year, what's gone on in South Africa politically since then. Well, there have been, as you can see, three peaceful elections starting in 1994. South Africa has elections on a five-year cycle. It's a parliamentary system so that when the elections are called, the political group that wins the election then will sit in parliament after the election and select a leader from amongst its members. And in the elections that have happened so far, the leader who's chosen to lead the country has also been the leader of the political party. So in 1994 is Nelson Mandela, and then Thabo Mbeki in 99 and 2005. And this year, assuming predictions are right, and there's no reason to assume that the current predictions are wrong, the ANC will once again win the parliamentary elections, and then the ANC will sit in parliament with the other members of parliament at the end of April, and a leader for the country will be selected. And so it looks like Jacob Zuma will be that leader, and we'll talk about Mr. Zuma in just a moment. But South Africa has, as compared to maybe some other African countries, managed, despite this bifurcated history, despite a very difficult history of apartheid, despite the history of discrimination, has still been able to manage three peaceful transitions, three reasonably democratic, peaceful transitions, not a lot of bloodshed the way people might have expected in the late 1980s or 1990s. And in addition to that, the country's been able to maintain, at least for the last several years, some very good growth rates. So up until this year, South African growth rates were averaging between 3 and 5% per annum. So some pretty solid growth. Everyone seems to credit Thabo Mbeki's leadership with maintaining macroeconomic stability in the country. So not large swings in terms of inflation. The debt has come down substantially. Tax rates within South Africa themselves have come down quite substantially. But in addition to these good things, there have been some other reasons to be a little bit concerned about what's gone on over the last several years. So one reason to be concerned are these domestic issues that I've talked about, which I'll get to in just a moment. But as you can see on the slide, we also believe that there are some challenges that South Africans face in terms of international opportunity. So South Africa is in this amazing position. It's the largest economy in sub-Saharan Africa. Right, it's anchoring the continent. It's that kind of weighty force at the southern tip of the continent. And not only is it a weighty force, it's a country that has an enormous amount of what economists might call reputational capital built up. A country that really has struggled in interesting ways to overcome a very difficult past has a kind of moral legitimacy that means it could potentially occupy a leading role on the world stage. And what we're asking in this paper is, are the South Africans squandering that heritage? And in particular, Did the Mbeki regime squander some of the goodwill that the previous regimes had built up in terms of the way it related in the international community to other countries, in terms of the role it played at the Security Council in particular, in terms of its support for the Zimbabwean regime? So Johan will talk about that, and I will talk about some other issues. Probably also important to point out for you, just in case you haven't been following this, that one of the reasons why this is such an interesting election in South Africa is that this year, the ANC is facing two challengers. They're facing actually more than two challengers, but just like in the U.S., everyone concentrates on the Republicans and the Democrats, and you forget about all the other little parties. In South Africa, everyone focuses on the ANC. Maybe every once in a while you hear about Inkatha Freedom Party, but not so much anymore. Democratic Alliance is the main opposition party. The Democratic Alliance is based in the Western Cape and sort of the white, more economically conservative party in South Africa. But this year there was a split in the ANC, which you all may know about. The party broke up, and a new party called the Congress of the People has been formed, and represents a challenge to the ANC's hegemony. So there's discord within the ranks of the ANC, people who were unhappy with the thought of a Zuma presidency, of Zuma leadership, and what that might mean economically and socially, have left the party to create this new party, which we call COPE. So interesting to see how this will play out. Pollsters are saying that the ANC is likely to get anywhere from 55 to 65% of the vote. DA will get a pretty significant chunk of that. And maybe this new party, maybe 6, 8, maybe something like that in terms of percentages. But whoever wins this election, and it almost surely will be the ANC, they have these challenges to face, and they are strong, and they are real challenges that are going to require some real reform. And what I think you don't see in the ANC's manifesto for this year's election is an indication of the sort of reform that would be most likely to benefit people at the very bottom of the economic spectrum in South Africa. So we focus on the need for a new government to increase opportunities for all South Africans. Maybe not just the people who are politically well-connected, maybe not the people who are associated or just focusing on people who are associated with labor unions, maybe not just focusing on the increasingly large black middle class, but focusing on what can be done in the policy environment to help the poorest South Africans. And we do believe that there are things, meaningful things that can be done. But then also the challenges are going to involve how can you deal or how can you right what are perceived by many people to be the wrongs of a misaligned foreign policy. When I think about South Africa, we've been there a number of times doing work, and we have some of our studies out on the tables outside. The person I always think of when I think about South Africa is the gentleman who's on the screen on your left, Michael Djwambi. And I want to talk about Mr. Djwambi for a moment because I think he's an interesting example of what South Africa could be if there were increased opportunities for entrepreneurship within the country. If it were easier for more people to be like Mr. Djwambi, you might see a different kind of a society. So let me tell you very briefly about him. I met him for the first time in 2005, and he's standing in front of a business he's built, a funeral business, that's providing insurance, a burial insurance basically, but providing some more traditional funeral services, so burial services as well. Mr. Djwambi, when he was a young man, he's about 54 in that picture. When he was a younger man, he was growing up under the apartheid regime, under those sorts of restrictions. So he had very limited opportunities legally in terms of what business could he enter, where could he travel, what could he hope to accomplish in his life. He illegally left the Eastern Cape where he was born and went to Cape Town, tried to find a job, did what many people do in that situation, became a domestic servant working for a family. In that capacity, he learned to drive. His boss taught him how to drive a car, and then subsequently he learned how to drive a truck. So he had some experience driving heavy equipment. Well, that gave him a skill set that was then tradable or transferable to other positions, and he actually got a job driving a bus in the southern along the coast of South Africa. And he told me when I met him he enjoyed this job. It was a good job for him, but literally on Christmas Eve in 1981, he was driving back home, sitting as a passenger in the front of the bus, and one of his buddies was driving the bus, and the bus was hit head-on in a collision. And Mr. Juambi lost his left leg up to his hip. So he's wearing an artificial leg in this picture. And for many people, that would sort of be enough to dent your spirit and to keep you from trying harder and doing more. In his case, the bus company fired him because they said, you can't drive anymore, you're missing a leg. But he realized he had learned enough about the bus business that he could go into back office at a different bus company and try to help with the management, which he did to great success. Great, he was just a great back office kind of guy, helping to rationalize the business. He was so good that he was able to sort of work his way up a little bit in that structure. He and his wife were able to save a little bit of money, and they opened what's called a spaza shop. They were living in Kailicha Township, which was a brand new township outside of Cape Town, huge township, a million people in Kailicha. They were living there, and very typical in black townships in South Africa, people will run individual stores. They'll have little tiny grocery stores, and you can go to your neighbor's house, and you can buy bread, or you can buy cornmeal, or you can buy stuff that you need right there without having to go back into the city, which is where the big grocery stores would be, right? There are no big grocery stores in the townships, so this was serving a need that had really been artificially created by the apartheid-era legislations and regulations. Anyway, Mr. Juambi and his wife run this little grocery store. He's working in the bus company. He's doing well. They're doing well. But he's just one of these people. I'm looking around the room for the person. One of you is this person in this room. He's one of those people who is going to be a successful entrepreneur. I'm looking around. Someone in this room is that person. It's not me, but one of you guys is. You can just tell talking to him that he's always thinking, how can I do more? How can I do it better? How can I find a way to make the customers happy? And so running his little spaza shop, he realized, you know, if I got a refrigerator here, if I got a generator and a refrigerator, because you can't trust the electricity, it's going to be going all the time, even back then, like today it's bad too. But if I got a generator and a refrigerator, I would have a comparative advantage with regard to the other folks running spaza shops, because I could keep the drinks cold all day long, or I could keep the meat cold all day long. I wouldn't have to buy a chunk of ice every morning, and by the end of the day it's melted and nothing's cold anymore, so that when people are coming back home from work in the evenings, they could get a cold drink, or they could get their meat and trust that it would still be cold. Terrific. This is a terrific idea. And he's huge. He's really successful. And so the story is he keeps doing stuff like this, innovating, bringing new products into the spaza shop, and he's a successful guy. This is not necessarily a good thing, though, is it? It's not necessarily a good thing because time's going by. It's the late 1980s. It's South Africa. There's a lot of violence in the townships. The South African Police Service is either fomenting violence in the townships or they're not doing anything about it. They don't want to go in and see what's going on in the townships. Long and short of the story is, in many cases, successful businesses were targeted for attack. And Mr. Juambi was targeted for attack. In the early 1990s, his store had been so successful, he was able to leave. They had started in a small shack. He was able to leave the shack. He built a two-story building, store on the bottom, family home on the top. Well, one night the store was attacked, and he had been selling paraffin to use for cooking. And the gang that attacked the shop ended up shooting using the paraffin as a way to burn down the whole building. In the process of being attacked, Mr. Juambi's brother-in-law was shot point blank in the head. His wife was murdered, and all his children were murdered. And his sister was murdered, and her child was murdered as well. He was the only member of the family who survived. Everybody killed, the store burnt to the ground. Here's a man who's lost his leg, who's overcome that, who's rebuilt businesses, created a life, loses everything. In a way, it's not an atypical story in South Africa. This kind of violence is still a really pervasive problem in the society. Well, you might think, okay, that's it. Juambi's done with, you know, and he tells the story. When he told the story, he was, you know, as anyone would be, really moved. But he wasn't done. He reopened the store on the exact same place, exact same spot, 1 year to the day after it burned down. And on that day, every item that he had stocked on the shelves was purchased by his community members in a show of support for him and for what he had been through. Well, so since that day, that was a terrible experience. Mr. Juambi has gone on to build other spaza shops. He's gone on to open other businesses. And he realized, you know, if I could get some additional training, because he really didn't have any formal, very much in the way of formal education,
if I could get some additional training, I think I could expand into other businesses. And so the funeral business, which sadly is a business that is a good business in South Africa as a result of the HIV/AIDS crisis. Well, I tell Mr. Juambi's story because he's sort of a wonderful example of what South Africa might be. Despite the limitations of the past, despite the problems that he's had to overcome, he's been able to do it. He was able to build businesses. Mr. Juambi in 2005 was employing 50 people at his different businesses. South Africa in 2005 had an unemployment rate of 27%. It's got a huge unemployment problem. But he was creating jobs in the micro and small enterprise sector. He was an effective job creator himself because he could see opportunity and figure out how to pursue that opportunity. And that's why, in my mind, it's both so characteristic and so tragic that I learned in November he was shot dead in front of the funeral business. A victim of the kind of crime that affects South Africans every single day of their lives. And this is what the government, in a way, his story encapsulates what the any new government needs to do. Any new government needs to facilitate Michael Juambi's. Find ways to encourage people, to incentivize people to create businesses, to become job creators themselves, but also find ways to limit the costs that are associated with doing business in South Africa, and part of the costs of doing business are the costs associated with violence and crime. Just a few statistics on what's it like to live in South Africa today. Again, that bifurcation that came from the apartheid era is still lingering and has effects in terms of the poverty profile of the country. So there still are a majority, it's still the case that a majority of South Africans are poor, and the vast bulk of the poor South Africans are black South Africans. Poverty rates for either the colored minority or for white people in South Africa are significantly lower, also for the Indian population in South Africa. Same thing as in most other countries. The households that are very poor oftentimes are women-headed, and women tend to have lesser education and lesser employment opportunities than men. And much of the poverty is still located in rural areas. This is not surprising given how little attention has been devoted to rural development in South Africa. So these are the problems that these three groups are going to face depending upon who takes over. Just quickly again, the ANC is the lead contender, and Jacob Zuma is the leader of the ANC, the likely next president of the country. COPE, the Congress of People, is headed by a gentleman that people don't know necessarily a whole lot about, Mr. Dandala, who has been the head of the Council of Churches in South Africa and is a Methodist preacher. And then the Democratic Alliance, which is headed by Helen Zille, who's the mayor of Cape Town, and an advocate for perhaps a lesser role of the government in terms of the economy. Here are the ANC's priority areas, and we largely track the ANC's priority areas in our policy series. They are concerned with how will you improve education in the country? How are you going to improve the crime rates in the country? How are you going to create jobs and then provide effective health care to the citizens who are poor, living in rural areas, who are suffering from a variety of different ailments? And then related, of course, obviously, is how are we going to get more rural development for the country so we're not so focused on the urban areas? I mentioned to you that unemployment rates are quite high in South Africa, and I just wanted to give you a quick comparison between the United States and South Africa. You can see that at the turn of the millennium, unemployment rates, this is a strict definition of unemployment, by the way. These are people who are actively looking for jobs in South Africa. That rate was 30% in 2001. That's a staggering number, right? We're staggered at the thought of 7% unemployment in the United States, but 30% unemployment. If we were to count in the folks who were discouraged and had stopped looking because they thought it was just hopeless, that number was up at 40% or higher in 2000. You can see the numbers have been coming down over time, and that's important progress, but not coming down nearly fast enough to really deal effectively with that problem of poverty in South Africa. So what explains these high unemployment rates in the country? And I think there are a couple of ways we can understand why South Africa has this problem. Part of the problem is the legacies of apartheid. People weren't trained well. They don't have good job skills. So many of the workers who are unemployed are low-skilled workers. In addition to that, they live far away from jobs, also as a result of apartheid, which means it's difficult for them and costly to travel to do job searches. So job searches itself are expensive for many people. People don't have the money to afford, they don't have the money to be able to afford doing job searches, so they don't look. There's a lot of supply now in the country. Imagine 30% of your workforce unemployed, all competing for the few formal sector, low-skilled jobs that there are. Think about the tension that's in a society like that. Tremendous amounts of competition that actually exploded last summer in real violence. Another problem is that in the formal sector, wage rates are fairly high as a result of union bargaining. There's sectoral minimum wages and sectoral bargaining about wages, and that tends to drive wage rates up for people who do have formal sector jobs. And then, in addition, many people will point to the fact that South Africa's labor regulations are, compared to many other countries, especially OECD countries, more rigid. And so it's more costly to hire people. It's more difficult to fire people. South Africa ranks pretty well in terms of the World Bank's Doing Business report, 34 this past year. But in terms of its hiring workers index, it's all the way down at 106. I believe, or 100, between 100 and 106. So it's quite difficult for the formal sector employers to hire, fire, keep workers in South Africa, and that contributes to the problem. So you've got a lot of unskilled workers available to do work in South Africa, but a lot of employers don't want to hire them, either because it's costly to hire them or because they don't have the training that's needed to compete in a globalized economy. Why don't they have the training they need to do well in the formal sector and formal sector jobs? In part, it's because the education system is not really doing its job for learners in South Africa. Unlike in the United States, or at least unlike until recently in the United States, education's a national shared it's a shared responsibility in South Africa. So the national government sets education policy, the provincial government's supposed to implement the policy, and then municipalities and parents are running the local schools. So compared to the United States, there's a bit more of a top-down approach, more of a centralized approach to dealing with education. Much of the education is public sector education. There's a small set of independent schools. Very large workforce, public school teachers are the largest segment of workers in South Africa in the formal sector. There's over 300,000 of them. But these teachers aren't creating good outcomes for students. South African students rank worse in terms of math skills, life skills, language skills than do students from Mali, for example, or Niger. Much poorer African countries do a much better job in terms of educating their students. There's a huge backlog in terms of infrastructure in the country. There are still schools that don't have toilets, still schools that don't have electricity. So the environment in which students are learning is a challenged environment. I've heard some talk about maybe splitting the education department in South Africa into two different departments, one that focuses on primary and secondary education and another department focused solely on tertiary and university education, but I haven't heard much about that since then. So there are real challenges in the education area, and there are unbelievable challenges in terms of crime, as you might be able to tell from the Michael Djwambi story. South Africa is although a little bit less violent today than it was a few years ago, is still an extraordinarily violent community. Every day in South Africa, every day, 365 days a week, the statistics are 50 people are murdered. 50 people, day in and day out. For a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's related to taxi violence, sometimes it's related to break-ins, variety of different reasons. South Africa was also just called the country outside of a war zone that has the highest level of sexual violence of any country in the world. So leave a war zone, go to South Africa, it's a very problematic place to be in. Also, lots of problems in terms of burglaries, break-ins, car hijackings, assaults, etc. Although the crime statistics seem to be trending downwards, it still is the case that this level of violence, which is pervasive in the country, you know, maybe not so much in the rural areas, but you can feel it in urban areas, is costly for businesses. It's costly for businesses because businesses lose property, they lose inventory, there are work disruptions, your workers can't get to work because they've been in a taxi that's been attacked and they can't get there.
There are all sorts of direct costs associated with violence in South Africa, but businesses have to spend money to protect their facilities. They've got to hire security guards. They've got to put iron bars on their windows, et cetera, et cetera. That's all money that could be spent growing a business, invested in a business that can't be. It's instead used to protect the business from predation, private sector predation. In addition, all this concern about crime leads small business people to say, do I really want to hire more people? Do I really want to go into business? Think about the sort of incentives created by someone who's entrepreneurial but learns about Michael Djwambi. Say Michael Djwambi's your neighbor. You know what he did. You know the kinds of businesses he created. And look what it led to. He became a target. Do you really have incentives to become a business person when there's a prospect that success itself means you become a target of violence? Here's an example of some of the sort of practical problems that result from high crime rates in South Africa. Vicky Mangaliso is the woman who's in these pictures, and I met her a couple of years ago in Langa Township, which is also outside of Cape Town. She and her brother Tam run a butchery. So you go in and you buy your meat from Vicky's store. Vicky was telling me that for her, the real costs of high levels of crime in her area are that she can't get the vendor who sells the meat she likes to come into the township. He just won't drive in. What does this mean? It means she still wants the meat, but it means she's actually got to work through a middle person to get the meat. She's got to hire someone who will go to the guy outside of the township, get the meat, and then bring it back into the township. So that's raising the cost for her of doing business. People don't feel safe, vendors don't feel safe going to particular parts of the country. But in addition to that, she's got to close her business earlier than she would like to because customers won't come out on the streets after a certain time at night. So she thinks she might be able to stay open until 9 o'clock at night, but people aren't going out in the dark. They don't want to be walking through the commercial center. They don't want to be working through the commercial center of Langa. Too dangerous. So she feels like she's losing business that way. And then in addition to that, there are the expenses she's got to incur, she and her brother, in terms of crime prevention. So they do have a security guard and they do have the bars on the windows. If she didn't have to spend that money, and if she were able to save money in these other areas by not having to go through a middleman to purchase her meat, she believed then that she would be able to hire more people to work in her store. So she'd be a job creator. She'd be a more vigorous, robust job creator, but for these problems. And that's just one example. Perhaps one of the more significant costs of the problems associated, the interrelated problems associated with lack of employment opportunities, poor education, and violence is that people in South Africa, poorer South Africans, view outsiders as competitors for what little there is to get in the society. So there was a lot of violence last summer directed at Zimbabwean immigrants who had left Zimbabwe looking for opportunity in South Africa only to come into competition with poor South Africans themselves, who are struggling to find formal sector jobs and don't want to compete with the Zimbabweans, who in some cases are probably better educated than the South Africans. So our recommendations in terms of dealing with this limited set of domestic issues are the following. Any new South African government needs to do more to help people create jobs. The government's position, the ANC position, is we will create the jobs. We will create the jobs through a set of public sector investment that's going to lead to a variety of employment opportunities. But what we're recommending is that probably the more sustainable path to job growth and job creation is to provide ways for the private sector as well to create jobs. In other words, to find ways to support the Michael Djwambis of South Africa, to support broader entrepreneurship. One way you can do this, a way that's been very successful in other countries, is to create special economic zones. And we think that this would actually be a really nice way to marry rural economic development and job creation in South Africa, because South Africa does have good infrastructure. And so you could create special economic zones in rural areas and still have reasonable opportunities to transport goods back to ports for export, if it were export-focused businesses. Secondly, we suggest creating a two-tier minimum wage in South Africa, one minimum wage for young workers who are unskilled. We would rather maybe that, you know, we didn't have to think too much about minimum wage, but since there's a minimum wage and that's not going away anytime soon, you know, facing the realities of it, we say
Why not a lower wage for the younger workers who don't have skills, that would provide an incentive for employers to hire those folks, provide them with some on-the-job training, and then they would graduate to the higher wage as they reach the age of maturity. So it could be that workers from the ages of 16 to 22 or 17 to 25 get the lower wage. Workers who are 22 or 25 or above get the higher wage. This has been tried in New Zealand. It's been implemented in New Zealand. And the New Zealanders have had some good success with that. I also recommend creating special exemption certificates for all workers. The problem with a two-tiered minimum wage is that it only helps young workers. But the people who are unemployed in South Africa aren't only the young. They're women. There are women who are over 25, they're older workers, they're rural workers, so how could you reach out to those people? One option would be a special exemption certificate, which would exempt workers and employers who hire them from some of the labor regulations that are currently in effect. So maybe you would have an exemption from the current minimum wage in your sector, or maybe you'd have an exemption from or a reduction in length of time for maternity leaves, which are 4 months now in South Africa, mandatory. Or maybe some reduction in terms of the annual leave, which is a 3-week annual leave guaranteed. So that special exemption certificate would be like creating a personalized special economic zone, but a zone that travels with the person. It's not geographically based.
In your study, did you look at possibility or the option of like microcrediting? Microfinancing at all?
Yeah, so we don't really talk about microfinance or microcredit. South Africa is one of the African countries that still has usury laws on the books, so there's a limit on interest rates that can be charged, and there's been a lot of good changes over the past couple of years, especially in making those limits, ensuring that those limits don't really frustrate the expansion of microcredit in South Africa. And there's some really good microcredit institutions in the country. Small-size entrepreneurs always say that they need more and better access to credit, and the banking sector in South Africa has an obligation to try to provide that credit. Some work has been done by creating these, you may know, the Mzansi accounts in South Africa, which are designed especially for the unbanked. So expanding opportunities for microcredit, if you can do that through a modified legal framework, is also a really good strategy, but not one that we actually talk about.
Okay.
In terms of the education, our strong suggestion is that there needs to be more competition in the education sector. There needs to be a more vibrant, more opportunities for both teachers and for parents to choose what to do. South African teachers are smothered under a set of rules and regulations that make it very difficult for them to actually teach. They've got reporting requirements that they themselves consider to be extremely onerous. They spend less and less time in the classroom and more time writing out reports. And so lifting some of those onerous reporting requirements would be useful. We also suggest maybe not applying the sectoral minimum wages for the education sector to private schools so that private schools have more freedom to hire at lower wage rates if they choose to. And then we recommend some modifications to teacher certificate requirements so that people can be hired based on field competence and not necessarily on having an education degree. And then finally, in terms of crime, I think it's fair to admit that this is a very deeply entrenched, very difficult problem. And as far as most people can see, not a lot of good options for dealing with this problem other than strengthening the South African police service and perhaps requiring stronger criteria for hiring within the police service, but then doing things like having more community involvement and encouraging people to report crimes. If people think the police aren't going to do anything because the police are complicit, they don't report crimes, and that's really a problem right now, especially in the townships in South Africa. It also seems like there's a pretty strong connection between crime within the townships and a strong disincentive to create township-based businesses or grow township-based businesses. So one possible alternative would be really focus crime reduction, crime prevention strategies on urban townships where there is good opportunity to build micro and small size enterprises. So at this point, I think we're ready to switch over to foreign policy, and my colleague Johan is going to take over from here.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. As Carol said, my name is Johan Vandewalt, and I'm the co-author on this paper. Thank you very much for coming, and if you will just bear with me for a few minutes, I'll walk you through the foreign policy section of this paper. As Carol has briefly touched on, South Africa has a lot of reputational capital. Many people predicted that after the transition in 1994, mass violence will incur and the society will in fact deteriorate. But that did not happen. I mean, Nelson Mandela took office, many good things happened, and subsequently South Africa, for a long period of time, became the leading voice for democratic governance. It took an increased role in trading with other African countries, many of which cannot trade internationally. In addition to this, South Africa also serves as the sole representative to many international forums. So, for instance, the G20 talks going on right now, South Africa is the only African country who's sitting in on those. So it carries a sense of responsibility in that sense too. In addition, because of its, this reputational capital, South Africa was also recently bestowed with a seat on the United Nations Security Council, many of which people view this as a very unique opportunity for a developing country to constantly give its input on some of the legislation and security concerns of the world. And then finally, South Africa has been host to many, many big sporting events. We've had a cricket, rugby, and now forthcoming next year, a Soccer World Cup, personal plug. If you've yet to buy your tickets, please do so and go spend your good American dollars. But with that being said, there are still many, many impediments that prevent South Africa from really realizing all the things that they can by being provided these opportunities. And one of that is a very confused regional trading environment. In this specific instance, it's worth to note that African nations have historically worked collectively to deal with the concerns related to trade, development, and security. Over time, a proliferation of organizations developed, like the African Union, the South African Development Community, South African Customs Union, the Common Market for Eastern and Southern African. But all because these things were created piecemeal, many of which did not necessarily consider the training requirements of other groups. And so over time, nations committed to a multiplicity of regional trade agreements, many of which come in conflict with each other. So consider one such country, Zambia. Zambia is both a member of the Southern African Development Community and COMESA. Underneath current SADC rules, the rules state that all countries part of SADC need to dismantle all trade barriers for goods originating within SADC countries. Concurrent with that, COMESA countries also are required to create a common external tariff for all goods originating outside COMESA. Now, Zambia is a country in both these places, but South Africa is not. South Africa is just part of SADC. So in doing this, Zambia is committed to both reducing all the trade barriers with South Africa, but also putting a tariff on all goods from South Africa. This multiplicity of memberships not only stunts further economic relations, but it limits reciprocity and trust when it comes to trade. This needs to be addressed. In addition to these regional trade agreements, there has been a tendency for some of these South African officials to have an inconsistent voice in international affairs. It is worth noting that human rights and human flourishing form the cornerstone of foreign policy underneath President Mandela's administration. But more recently, and with the Thabo Mbeki administration, the rhetoric of African dialogue and African solutions to African problems became the forefront of foreign policy. And in this capacity, many have stated that it's almost a false dichotomy has been set up. In particular, those who view this African solidarity to be the solution do not consider the policy recommendations made by more developed countries advancing more of the world economic agenda to be worthwhile. And so one area in which this has been particularly problematic is the United Nations Security Council. South Africa has on several occasions now voted with China and Russia to veto human rights condemnations in countries such as Myanmar and Darfur. And many have said this is simply because of the side, not of the issue. This needs to be addressed. In addition, many more countries in the African continent are choosing to legitimize their governments through elections. This is undoubtedly a positive development, because until recently, it was not uncommon for most African leaders to stay in power for extensive periods of time. However, in this specific instance, there's also an increased probability for election fraud and violence. So it's our recommendation that South Africa focus more extensively on creating a robust strategy for monitoring elections. So with that being said, these are the policy recommendations from my section of the paper. In particular, we would say to any new government to move forward with the current strategies the Eastern African Community, COMESA, and SADC have, insofar as reducing the multiplicity of memberships. What these countries are doing is creating a common customs union, one economic union, and removing all external tariffs that currently exist. In so doing, many of these countries that exist within these broader strips on the African continent will no longer have to commit themselves to many organizations at the same time, but rather they'll be part of one big agreement. In addition to that, we also recommend to the South African governments to adopt a more principled approach to foreign policy. South Africa was destined to play a very unique role in the African continent post the 1994 elections, but many things have gone awry since then, and we hope that a new government will look back at the legacy the Nelson Mandela administration left behind and adopt some of the more principled human rights-based approaches that he advocated for. In addition to that, we also encourage the South African government to work forward and work with other international efforts to monitor elections. As stated, more countries are legitimizing their elections, but many countries do not have the capacity to necessarily monitor and structure the necessary processes to avoid good input into the African governments and into these elections. And so with that being said, the recommendations we have are for the South African government to make impartial observers available to countries at times when they need to receive input on how to best structure the process. As useful as these impartial observers are, they do not always produce the outcomes desired. So for instance, in many instances, one could say that the Kenyan elections of 2007 had many impartial observers, but the outcome of that was mass violence. And so in this specific instance, we need to keep in mind that also mechanisms need to be put in place that reprimand countries who do not necessarily abide by the international standards set forth. And so in that capacity, South Africa needs to work with organizations and other international efforts to set reprimandations in place to avoid countries to act forward and to continue to act destructively. And finally, and this is one of my things I'm very passionate about, is if South Africa successfully adopts reform policies and moves forward and cleans its internal house, then mechanisms need to be in place for other countries to learn from these experiences. South Africa can really influence other countries by attraction rather than coercion. If institutions are able to expand education, cultural, and professional exchanges, other countries will be able to come in and see this is how a country has moved from a particular point where it has a very problematic history to one where it's now functioning fairly effectively with a very, very heterogeneous population. In addition to that, South Africa has a very robust civil society, and as most of us know, a robust civil society is integral to a robust and stable democracy. Many other African countries lack this. And we hope that South African civil society initiatives can expand, and it can expand specifically into the African continent so that they are able to share best practices, provide input and ideas, and ultimately allow people from all walks of life to work with each other. At Fruition, Carol and I would really like to see an expansion of opportunity. And the best way for us to really state this is to use the words of Trevor Manuel. And this was said a few weeks ago in preparation for the current G20 talks. South Africa must diversify to get through the current financial crisis. But that is up to the entrepreneurs. Unfortunately, governments are pretty bad at creating entrepreneurs like Michael Drumby. So with that being said, thank you very much for listening to us. For more information about our program and to obtain PDF copies of these documents, please visit our website, and we will now take questions. Thank you.
So if you'd just like to tell us to whom your question is directed or if it's a general question, it'd be great.
And as a reminder, please fill out
your... Yeah, you got to fill out your green forms. Don't leave without filling out your green forms.
You sound like very... sound like very interesting policy ideas. Is the Zuma government going to go...
For any of it.
Yeah.
So actually, in the longer piece, we recognize that these are the sorts of policy recommendations that are not going to be especially, the Zuma government will not be especially receptive of, particularly, but that's a shame, right? I mean, the point of what you'd like, the point of the paper is to say, look, people who are poor need opportunity as well. And while it's likely that the Zuma government, whose two main allies are the Communist Party and the Congress of South African Trade Unions, are not likely to adopt policies that are going to put trade union jobs at risk, it's nonetheless important to state all South Africans need opportunity, not just people who are politically well-connected. But realistically, we understand.
I'm just curious of what you think the role of the U.S. government should be, or Congress specifically, in terms of some of the priorities that you highlighted in your speech, particularly education, crime. We're already doing a lot in terms of health, in terms of HIV,
yeah, sure.
AIDS. But I mean, are there things that Congress should be doing or looking at in its legislation to help South Africa with its issues in education and crime in particular?
So I think there are some things to be considered. I think it would be reasonable, for example, on the education front, to take a look at some of the work that the World Bank has done on private education for the poor, and see if there aren't some ways for the U.S. Congress to facilitate the growth of private education initiatives for the poor, especially for the poor in urban areas. This is there's a growing literature on how educational entrepreneurs can meet the needs of children in, say, slum areas of Lagos or in Nairobi or in a variety of different places in India. So I think that's a really interesting opportunity. There's a lot the U.S. can do to encourage, I think, even though we don't talk about this specifically, to address things like improving land security and maybe trying to keep the new government from engaging in some of the sorts of actions that the Zimbabwean government has engaged in terms of redistributions that have been forcible and contrary to the rule of law. So, for example, some more vocal support for recent SADC legal decisions supporting argue that the land seizures were illegal might be a useful position for the U.S. government to undertake. In terms of crime, what seems to be useful is finding small-scale experiments that are going to work in particular locations. And American cities have dealt with many of the same problems that South African urban areas are dealing with. And so it's possible that an exchange of police services and learning opportunities based on what urban, you know, a variety of different police services have found to be effective here in the U.S. would be really helpful for the South Africans. You know, you can imagine a delegation of folks from D.C. or Chicago or L.A. Going to Johannesburg or Cape Town and trying to lend a hand with that.
From the U.S.'s perspective, in terms of reducing the multiplicity of these regional economic associations, would you have a particular recommendation of which organization would be most likely to be, should be strengthened as opposed to the others weakened, for example, the African Union or another, you know, politically and economically valid institution that might supersede the others?
Yeah, I mean, I think my answer to your question is twofold. One is the current recognition by the COMESA, EAC, and SADC communities to move forward with best components of each, mm-hmm. and then ultimately take that into create a common external tariff to create reduced trade barriers, and all of these are very good. But one of the recommendations Carol and I floated around in the very beginning of the paper is maybe looking at the South African Customs Union. It is one of the oldest customs unions within the world. It has been very effective for a long period of time, and it has produced the necessary economic growth for many of the countries that have participated in it. But that's not denying that SAPU does have its shortcomings, which, you know, is a different conversation. So I would say that possibly the best thing to do for a U.S. government would be to take the best parts of each of these, because they do lie on local knowledge within these respective communities, and then put together an institutional framework that leverages the components and the successes of each of these regions into one more stronger, united, rationalized African trading system.
And there does seem to, you know, there is good movement on this front, actually. The chart that we showed you is like the most extreme case of overlapping jurisdictions and rules of origin conflicts and tariff, redundant tariff problems. The Africans themselves, with sort of being pushed by the Europeans and maybe to a certain extent by the Americans, are moving towards larger size trading arrangements. So it's likely that within the next couple of years, rather than having that spaghetti thing that you saw on the slide, you'll have maybe three regional agreements. So you'll have a large West African trade group, a large East African trade group, and then the Southern Africans trading together. And as Johan said, SAPU has been a very successful trading arrangement since the 1920s. 1910. And if you look at which countries in Africa are the wealthier countries, they're SAPU members. They're Namibia, South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho and Swaziland, not so much. But anyway, there does seem to be movement towards more rationalization, and that'll be very useful, reducing the sort of complexities that now exist in those areas.
China, as you mentioned, has recently been flexing their
international muscles and presumably influence the recent decision by the Dalai Lama. What has been their major investment on the continent, but specifically with South Africa, and what do you think the U.S. ought to be doing to provide counter-influence to what China is doing?
So I don't know what the largest Chinese investment is in South Africa. Overall, the largest investments have been in the extractive industries, I believe. So in terms of leasing, whether it's leasing copper, rights to mine copper in Zambia, or rights to mine additional minerals in DRC. That's my sense, that they're very heavily, they're investing significantly in the resource sector. But Johan, you might have a better sense than I in South Africa.
I think that China's role with South Africa has been more one of a very, very big trade partner. I mean, most recently it became known that South Africa is China's biggest trading partner on the African continent. And so it is China's growth and the need to gain more access to these mineral resource-rich areas. And Carol mentioned that many of these are areas that need some foreign direct investment, but one of the legacies of apartheid, though, is the fact that these are fairly well-developed modern technologies, so not too much investment are within these areas, as might be the case with some other African countries where there's a huge absence of investment to actually get these possibly very opportunistic industries to get going. Insofar as what the United States can do, I mean, that's a very good question. Like, I've not really thought about that too much, but...
So, look, I think it's fair to say that when you travel in Africa, and those of you who do know this, there's growing resentment of the Chinese on the ground in Africa. There was a real problem recently in Zambia with Chinese traders who were perceived as being in competition with local traders. There's a real concern over the fact that the Chinese come in and do these jobs. They do infrastructure jobs. They're engaged in mining operations, and they bring their labor with them. And they're not utilizing local labor. So to the extent that the U.S. government is involved directly as a contractor, using local labor is a way to distinguish yourself from the Chinese. Now, using local labor has its own set of difficulties, perhaps in a given environment, but it's really problematic that the Chinese are not extending their economic reach. They're making a contribution to the economies to some degree. I don't want to suggest that. But they're not integrating into the communities the way that probably an American firm or the U.S. government would be able to. So to the extent that American firms can be encouraged to also use local labor would be probably would be one way to make that distinction clearer. Hey, how are you?
For either one of you. Has there been any moves afoot for the professionalization of the local police force there? And I ask this because I was there about a little over 20 years ago, and I was very surprised. I was not surprised that black Africans were very skeptical and suspicious of police forces, and they didn't tell their kids, if you get lost, go see a police officer. Mm-hmm. That was the last thing they did. But I was also surprised by the numbers of white South Africans, liberal and conservative, who also privately did not view the police forces as very capable. They kind of said, if you're really dumb, you go into the police force. And so the use of force was an issue even among white South Africans, seemingly on both sides of the aisle. Has there been a move to change that or try and change? So it's not just the politicization, depoliticization, but professionalization.
Yeah, there's been efforts have been made to address this problem, but this is still a major problem in the country. So there's talk at every election cycle about the need to increase the qualifications of candidates who are coming into the police service to ensure that they have good literacy skills, to ensure that there are not problems associated with corruption within the police. For those of you who know South Africa, you know all about the taxi violence in South Africa. At the early stages of the taxi violence, the violence was happening because the police were siding with particular taxi organizations against other organizations and, taking some of the revenue from the taxi. So there's still corruption within the police itself, and there's not been the kind of professionalization that would give people real confidence in the police. And that's why people don't, even today, they're not reporting crimes to the police. You know what they use the police for? This is a curious thing. Here's one way I saw a lot of people using the police. It's very expensive to transfer property in South Africa. So the people don't go to lawyers to transfer property because the lawyers have a monopoly on conveyancing and registering properties and deeds. But they will go to the police service and say, what's your first name?
Kristen.
So Kristen's a police officer. So I'll go in and I'm selling my house to Johan. Johan and I will go into Kristen and say, would you just sign this affidavit for us saying that I'm selling my house to Johan? And this has, like, this is not legal. There's no legal authority here. But you get the police officer's signature on the piece of paper that's not going to hold up in a court. And, you know, it's a funny thing when your police service is signing affidavits about transfers of home sales, but, you know, you don't call them when you think something's going wrong in the local community. So it's a really big problem. Yeah.
What do the police officers charge for an affidavit?
You know, apparently you can go in with a bottle of beer. You can go in with some beer. And that's okay, but, you know, then that has its other costs associated with it. But it's not so expensive to do it that way.
I was curious about the two-tier minimum wage.
Uh-huh.
Maybe the New Zealand experience offers insight to this, but does it provide any market distortions on the labor market for overutilizing the younger crowd that is up to and just under that age cap, if that's the cap is used? And underutilizing those people who fall above it.
Yeah, that is a problem. It is a problem with it. And we raise this issue because the main policy recommendation that's been offered in terms of wage rates in South Africa is by some researchers at Harvard who are recommending a targeted wage subsidy. So provide to employers a wage subsidy to hire the unemployed. And what we suggest is, well, you know, you could do that, but then that's going to create some distortions of its own. So while this creates some distortions and may incentivize hiring younger folks, at least those younger folks are going to graduate out of the program pretty quickly. And you know, the New Zealand experience seems to suggest it's not a major distortion. It's maybe at best a minor distortion. The New Zealand experience also suggests the age range narrows very quickly because the other workers don't like the competition. And so in New Zealand, it started off 16 to 20, I think, and it's narrowed down, so it's just 16 and 17 now. It's only a two-year band. And so you'd expect that to happen in South Africa as well if it were a policy that were adopted. Okay, well, thank you. Hanger, thank you so much for those of you who are still here. Sure appreciate your attention.